Hi, I'm the self-development coach, Johnny Lawrence, and welcome to the Self-Development Podcast.
Imagine if you never had a sugar donut and somebody gives you a sugar donut and you taste that sugar donut and mind blowing, right? And then you go away having finished the donut and you think, oh, you know what, I'd really fancy another one of those donuts. And that's the arousal curve starts then. Neurochemically, what happens is just thinking about it starts the little, that starts the band playing, right? So the dopamine's going in there, the endorphins are going in there, and you're starting to think about it. Okay, now you're thinking about the donut. Now you want to go and get the donut. Okay, because you're anticipating what's going to happen. You haven't had the donut yet. It's an inert bloody object.
In this episode, I'll be chatting with Quint Bauer. Quint is the proud founder of Shoot You, which supports companies in producing animation and video for business communications, including 14 Fortune 500 companies on their roster. Psychology has been a lifelong personal passion for Quint, and this is evident in his use of animation to advance the delivery of mental health and well-being within healthcare and educational institutions. He's had the pleasure of spending the past 40 years working in the film, television, and radio industries. Shoot You have produced animation and video for over two decades, working with clients worldwide, including the BBC, JP Morgan, MasterCard, and Honeywell, just to name a few. Their broadcast experience, honed while working at the BBC, ensures clients enjoy the highest degree of professionalism and production values. They deliver all formats, platforms and channels, and have massive experience in tailoring content for social media. I've been super excited about this conversation. How are you today, Quint?
Hey, Johnny. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks. I'm great. Thanks very much for that intro. Lovely.
Yeah. Lovely. Well, you know, I think anyone that listens to the podcast now knows that sometimes I butcher that. So thank you for not laughing. But I actually don't think I went too badly. So how are you today, anyway?
I'm good. It's Friday the 13th. I seem to be making it through unscathed thus far, but
what incisive questions
you're going to ask me.
That's like driving down the motorway and turning to somebody sitting next to you and saying, oh, we're doing good time, aren't we? You know that round that corner is just red lights. Yeah, you're definitely throw caution to the wind there. But I mean, I've been looking forward to it. I was saying to you just before we started, like, I was looking at your Instagram and some of the videos you put up, and they're extremely powerful, mate. They really are. They really are really well done. I just I said to you again, like, the one with the black and white one with the red wine, super powerful. Really resonated with that a lot.
Thanks, Johnny. Yeah, I mean, as this conversation goes on, we can sort of talk about animation and how I feel it can be used towards mental health and well-being. It's only recently become possible to use it, but I think it's really got a place as a part of any sort of multimodal intervention on any of the presenting problems, really, depression, trauma, addiction, self-harm, eating disorders, you name it. I think there is a place for animation in order to try and shed some light on the causes and hopefully some insights onto some curative process as well.
Yeah, I mean, come to think of it, I suppose animation is sort of like the early years sort of experience, isn't it? It's like we as children, even we watch animation. That's how we fall in love with entertainment and characters and storytelling in some ways. Yeah. You know,
If you want to get into it, animation's been around since probably about the 1930s, where you've got Steamboat Willie and Mickey Mouse, and it goes all the way up to the present day, obviously. But there was a real inflection point around 1990s, where with Jurassic Park, basically. And then Toy Story, which was the first fully animated movie. Really from then on, computers started to get faster, the software started to get better, and now it's possible, well, around 2014, it became possible for companies like mine to produce animation for their clients, which coincidentally was the same time that a lot of the tech became so complex, it was the only way to show it, you know, because you can't actually take a mobile phone or a server and make it interesting unless you're showing what that mobile phone can do or what that server can do.
I mean, that's a good point, because I mean, like, animation it, like Pixar, for example, sometimes when you're watching a Pixar film, it actually looks real. Like, it's just incredible how advanced it is. And, you know, I think that's it. You're dealing with, and you've decided to deal with some very real topics as well. So I can see how you've got really creative with it. There's so much to it. And I want to get into that. But I think it'll probably be worth starting with you telling people a bit about yourself, your company, Shoot You, and all the incredible stuff that you're doing.
Okay. So my name's Quint Boer. I'm founder of Shoot You. We started on my birthday, which is the 21st of June, 2000. My history was my father, Bruce Boer, was an American actor. He was the American in Fawlty Towers. He wanted a Waldorf salad. Sally was apples, walnuts, grapes. Then he did Empire Strikes Back and Full Metal Jacket. And anyway, so I was steeped in film and television from quite an early age. And basically, in year 2000, I set up Shoot You because it became possible to produce video and animation using computers. So you could use a mini DV camera, you can go and shoot something, the computer would ingest it, you could edit it, and you could provide it on VHS, which is a format that is before your time, Johnny. It's a little tape that... Oh, really? Oh, okay.
42, and I remember it vividly.
So then we continued to do that. Basically, what we did, we provided videos for, field marketing. So you go to a station and boys and girls are handing out little bottles of Actimel, for example, you know. So we'd film that. We put some metrics around it. The field marketing company would give it to the PR company, who give it to their client. And everybody loved it. Everybody loved video. It's innovative, right? So and then we started producing directly for the PR companies. Then we started producing directly for the clients. So we got quite a good start. It's just me and a few others. And we got an office in just outside of Weybridge. And in 2008, the financial crisis happened. And we were working with Bear Stearns, which was a bank at the time that got gobbled up by JP Morgan. And so we then started to work direct with JP Morgan, which was fantastic. So we produced a lot of video for them, still do. 2014, animation came along. We started to produce animation. And by now the company was probably about 20 people strong. And then really what happened was 2016, Brexit happened. We had to open an office in Amsterdam to keep working with our European clients. And then we opened in New York. And then we opened in Los Angeles, and then we did, a hockey stick. They call it in business a hockey stick. It just went like da 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 da, and suddenly wallop. And now we're 60 people strong in New York, Los Angeles. We're opening in Munich, Zurich, Singapore. Now it's terrific. I mean, it's a real fairy story, Johnny.
Yeah.
There was no venture capital came in. It was just what happened, and yeah. And so the reason for that really is because companies now can see video and animation as a communication resource. The internet's there, social media's there, and they all want to use video and animation, which, is a great tool to communicate ideas.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And the way that you guys do it as well, the creativity, the fact that they're all so different is just incredible. It really is. And you're using animation to get across sometimes quite complicated and complex seemingly like psychological concepts or mental health ideas and strategies. So it sort of begs the question, really, like, what inspired your sort of lifelong passion in psychology?
Well, I had an aunt and uncle. My aunt was Marion Woodman, and as you can see on the bookcase behind me, maybe she was a Jungian analyst, and she was one of the first people to identify the sort of the mind-body relationship and its relation to eating disorders. And then I had an uncle called Fraser, who was very much, he was also a Jungian analyst, and he was into dreams. And they were a very big part of my life. So I always had that psychological background that was there. Now, they were in Canada, I was over here, but it did set me on the path of looking more closely at psychological ideas, such as, obviously Jung and Freud and Carl Rogers and cognitive behavioral therapy and Nietzsche and Sartre and all of these other ideas. And that's what I pursued personally and then formally With an MA and with various certificates, with, you know, the UKCP and BPS and everybody else. And then I started a private practice. So what we have is kind of two tracks. You got the film, television and voiceovers, and you got the psychology as well. And that's how I lived my life in my 20s and 30s before Shoot You got started. And what, yeah, in fact, I'm back to.
Well, that's what I sort of am alluding to, really, because, like, it's interesting that you've got this clear passion for psychology and this clear passion for animation, and they don't necessarily have to come together, but they did. And that's where creativity is born, when passions comes together, you know, and they create that sort of platform to get the ideas out there. And you know, if you're into psychology, you can get a bit out there, can't it, anyway? But you know, and animation's the perfect way to sort of translate it and get it over. So what was your experience in private practice? Why did you decide to move away from that?
Well, I've had a private practice for about 4 years, and by private practice I mean that I had my own setup. I worked with charities like Turning Point. I worked within organizations, and I worked in particular what was called employee assistant programs, which I don't know many of your listeners, how many of them will know what that is, but basically most companies, let's say an off license, will have insurance that if that off license gets knocked over, that the staff there will have access to shrinks who will talk to them about their experiences. And that was just coming to happen back in the 90s. And I was one of the vanguard for it. So basically, if there was a major, well, an incident, whether that's a sort of road traffic accident or an industrial accident or something like that, they would send in, you know, three or four people in order to talk to the staff of what had happened. And using what was then the Mitchell 7-point plan, which was developed by the Army, talk them down. So critical incident debriefing became trauma counseling. Yeah, and the principles are the same, roughly, that. So when you're dealing with trauma, I'm going a little bit off topic.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
When you're dealing with trauma, what you've got is somebody who is quote unquote normal, who's been faced with an extraordinary event. So, you know, anybody, well, God forbid that anybody listening to this should suddenly see somebody knocked down in the street. It is literally, it is beyond words. You know, your mind just cannot process it. So what you do is you internalize it, and somehow, in a way that we're only just starting to realize or start to understand with the work of people at Van der Kolk and neuroimaging as well, somehow that thing for which you are lost for words, for which you cannot somehow process yourself, gets stored away, but it comes out in other ways. So classically, it comes out with hallucinations, so auditory hallucinations, olfactory hallucinations, visual hallucinations, and you become wired for this. So the next time you hear a bang, you think it's a gunshot. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of the work on trauma has come around with military vets, you know, from the First World War up to the present day, and it's got into the diagnostic manuals as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is how it's labeled today. And that's what I was doing. So then what happened to me was that I saw the possibility of moving totally into a totally different area, and I saw the possibility of starting a production company, and I went into that. I didn't let go entirely of the private practice, as we'll see later on in this podcast, because life events suddenly kind of bit me in the ass and I came back to it. But it meant I sort of let it go for a little bit. Then I came back to, I guess in your words, really merging the two with animation and psychology and psychotherapy, and that really is what I'm trying to pursue very, very strongly today, and hope to probably for the rest of my days.
Yeah, your story sort of has a real sort of meant to be element to it. It feels like, you know, you had to have those two sort of seemingly separate experiences, in one in animation, the other one in psychology. And then I can only imagine there must have been a light bulb moment of like, wait, I can do these together. This would be really good. This would be really fun. This would help people. and which sort of ticks all the boxes for most people. But I mean, like, how has that passion for psychology sort of impacted you on a personal level?
Well, I think everyone is a natural psychologist. So I think everybody is impacting me the same way that it does everyone else. I mean, you know, what is the meaning and purpose of my life are concerns for me. You know, family questions, how do I navigate the dynamics of my family? How do I manage day to day, you know, bills and the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that happened to all of us? How can I live my best life? You know, what am I doing? Where am I going? These are all ideas that that even shrinks think about, you know, and it's a total preoccupation.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I guess what, I mean, I've certainly, you know, come to some conclusions around it. And we are living at a time when there is so much more information which informs some of the ideas behind it. So we just lived through the decade of the brain with MRI imaging and CAT scans and so forth. So for example, with a lot of the presenting problems, we can see now the biological correlates of what's going on, you know, psychologically. Sorry, I'm not answering your question.
No.
Or maybe I'm avoiding it. I don't know.
No. But that's what you're saying there is right. You know, that we have got access to so much knowledge now, but sometimes that knowledge doesn't inform. It only serves to confuse, doesn't it? And we get that misinformation and that misunderstanding. Because what I see a lot with clients, especially, is they have this feeling. So they feel a certain way and they don't want this feeling. They don't welcome it. They don't want to feel this way. But at the same time as they don't want to feel this way, they're also telling themselves they shouldn't feel this way. They're also telling themselves, actually, I don't feel this way. And they're not getting honest with themselves because they do feel this way. And that's what's important. And until you raise awareness of this thing that you're feeling, that you're telling yourself you shouldn't or you're not, it's never going to really change, is it? You're never going to evolve.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if we just go back to trauma for a second, one of the things that one of the wonderful things, you know, when I said that people who are in trauma are people who are normal people who have been in an extraordinary situation. Mm. And so they have these flashbacks and they all think they are going mad. All of them. Why do I feel like this? This is not normal. I'm going insane here. And so you go in there suited and booted and you sit down. And you tell them, actually, a flashback is completely normal. Mm. It's completely normal to have nightmares about this. It's completely normal to have these sweats and these hallucinations. That it resets them. And the same thing with addiction. And I'm talking clinically and personally. That when I hear other people in a room talking about how they feel about alcohol or how they feel about themselves and their feelings about alcohol, which is kind of another layer on top of the onion, then it completely chimes with me. So you got the person feeling uncomfortable, then the person beating themselves up for feeling uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this ever receding sort of, you know, hall of mirrors that you've got that really just draw a line through that, you know. If you could sit down with a pen and paper, you know, cognitive behavioral stuff, and just say, look, this is it, and draw the line there.
I was talking to someone about this the other day, and I was talking about the idea of your authentic self and your conditioned self, and your conditioned self is all of the cues and all of the other people's desires and preferences all sort of passed over to you, and you either take them on or you don't. But what can end up happening is that authentic self learns to not feel valid or not think that they should be a certain way, they should be that way. And quite often when you speak to somebody, they strayed so far away from their own personal value system. It doesn't have to be sinister. No one's trying to do it to you on purpose, but maybe you're in a relationship with somebody and they have a certain value system and you inadvertently adopt it. And that's okay, but you have to know that's what's happening. And actually, when you get, I don't know, 2 or 3 years down the line and you're super unhappy, it might be because you're working in this job that you hate and you just won't admit it to yourself, or you're in a relationship that you're not happy in and you can't admit it to yourself because your parents tell you, oh, you should give it a good go. Well, yeah. I'm not happy. And that's what we're trying to pursue, really. We, as human beings, I feel strongly that we naturally gravitate towards things that make us feel good, and we try and get away from the things that make us not feel so good, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love everything that you're saying. It's we clearly sing from the same hymn sheet here, I think.
Yeah, but, definitely.
But the concept of using animation to get across mental health ideas, challenges, tools, and solutions is absolutely inspired. Mm. It really is. And the way that you do it is just remarkable. So how did that moment happen for you when you thought, wait, you know, I'm a psychologist, I've got this practice, but I also got this passion as well for animation. What was sort of like the baby of it, you know?
Well, I spoke to a teacher. And so this was about after 4 years of doing animations for big clients, you know, for household names. And they were good animations. And I spoke to a teacher, and this is what happened. They had a fight in the classroom, and she was hit by the student. And it was just about just raw anger coming out of this kid. And she said to me, she said, you're doing all of these animations for insert name of company here, but you know, that's what we need. We need an animation so that kids can look at their anger, not as anger as sort of, oh dear, you've got anger, but looking at the roots of the anger and taking them back, because they have got enough nous about themselves, because they understand that the roots of it isn't, you know, that's the straw that broke the camel's back. Some kid calling another kid a, you know, whatever epithet, and that kid lashing out and beating seven bells out, and then a teacher stepping in, and then the teacher being hit too. You know, that's so what I did was produce the animation on anger, which the school used and still uses to this day, where they sit down with the kid and they watch the animation and they say, and we provide stills from the animation as well, what about this animation spoke to you? You know, do you feel less than? Do you feel that the you know, compare and despair, that the other kids are getting ahead of you or getting preferential treatment? You know, what is it about this situation? Practical things as well. Are you hungry? I mean, it's coming up today. You know, are you basically just so hungry and tired? You know, is there addiction going on in your home? You know, that'll start creeping up too. So what's going on for you that you lashed out at some kid this afternoon because he called you something or she called you something? And it's that animation we produced for them, and then it won an award and it got a load of traction. And then I thought, well, hang on, this is really handy, because if we've got an animation there, we can disseminate it using Instagram. So I set up my own personal Instagram account. I did one on alcohol, which was the same animator, then on trauma, then on depression, then on domestic violence, because we were, sorry, to put some context around this, this was COVID, right? This is coming off of the back of COVID. So of course we've got these double digit increases in every single presenting problem, and the healthcare services were and are completely overwhelmed. I mean, good luck getting an appointment with the CAMS right now, you know, and this was a way for kids to access an animation anonymously on their mobile phones, you know, to have some practical tools to deal with things, to some information to maybe call, you know, Samaritans, Childline, you know, whoever, and for the teachers as well to look at their own anger, last but not least. I mean, that came out of it, because the teachers have got as many, you know, challenges as the kids often.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, that stuff you say around anger is so complex. It's so complex, because anger essentially is a reaction to an emotion. It's not an emotion. You know, so you've got
controversial.
Yeah, it is. But you know, that's the view I take anyway. I take the fact that if somebody says to me, "Oh, I'm angry," I'm always angry. I am angry. They're making themselves angry for a start, because they're telling themselves that's what they are. But my question is always the same: what are you angry about? We dig deeper, and they're angry about some form of resentment or neglect or some really other difficult emotion, loneliness, whatever it is. But that's the emotion essentially that you were experiencing. Anger's difficult. Most of the time, you just look at someone who's angry and you kind of just got to wait for them to stop being angry, or they need to find an angry outlet of some kind. But it sounds to me like what your animation did, first and foremost, gave a much search for permission to these kids to communicate, but it also offered them the language to communicate. Because without them animations, they don't have anything that, you know, they're not adults. They don't have decades of experiences to draw upon to be able to sort of articulate how they feel. So instead, by showing them this animation and asking them questions, you're offering a language to them, aren't you? A way to communicate.
So the way that it was expressed to me was that the kids up to puberty, they're the authors. If we take the idea of inner narrative, right? So up to the age of maybe 10, 11, 12, they're the actors of their lives. They're just acting and it's all happening to them and they're just bobbing along with it, you know? But then when puberty hits, they become the authors. And they start to develop an inner narrative, right? Now, to your point, the animation gives them permission to engage in alternative ways of being. So now you've got a perception, right? Now they're one step removed from their behavior. And if the teacher can catch that, then you got a chance of maybe looking at another perspective and another way of being. That's really powerful stuff.
Oh, that is. And what I can hear in that as well is it also offers them the opportunity of choice. At first, it's like, this is just the way I do things. But when you go, yeah, it has been. But now I'm saying to you, what about this? What about that? You've now got a choice because you've gained an understanding of another way of doing things. Until then, it's like I was talking to someone the other day and they were telling me about something to do with their partner not communicating. So I quite controversially said to them, speak to me in Chinese. And they said, well, I can't speak Chinese. I said, no, but I want you to speak to me in Chinese. And they said, well, I can't. I said, so you're telling me there's nothing you could do right now to speak Chinese to me? He said, yeah. I said, well, imagine if Chinese was communication. If you don't know how to do something, you can't do it. And it doesn't matter how much I want you to, how much I ask you to, you're unable to do it. You know, and I think what you're doing there is you're, first of all, giving them permission, which children need permission often. And then you're giving them the language and then you're giving them some tools. I just think it's fantastic. I really do. Yeah. I really
do. Oh, good. The other thing, and since we're talking about psychology, and they haven't worked this out yet, but there's something about animation that's distinct from video and it's distinct from text, that it just, with perception, it goes in and it just goes straight to the emotions. Mm. It's not cognitively processed, right? So you watch a kid watching an animation, whether it's Frozen or Toy Story or one of those animations that we produce, and it goes in, and then afterwards they think about it. And it's only afterwards as they start to process it. Now you've got a client patient who is in flight, fright, freeze, right? Because of whatever. And they're cognitively restricted in what they can think about. They are just doing what they know best. They reverted to type. Those old scripts that they learned back when they were kids, well, they're right back in play now. You know, they are there, absolutely. They may not work, but they're comfortable because I'm not going to try anything new while I feel like this. Mm. But somehow you give them an animation and you know what? It's not threatening, you know? And if it's and the thing is, Johnny, right? If it's actors, and we've done this with UNICEF, we've tried this on a couple of animations. But if you use videos where there are people, you're looking at a person, and you're starting cognitively to look at that person, right? Are they? You know, how old are they? Are they black or white? Are they gay or straight? And you start looking at that person, and your prejudices start coming through, and you're not listening to what's going on. You're somehow engaging another part of your brain, and that story is going to start to have a narrative before you've even seen what's going on. But if you've got an animation, right, and bear in mind, right, it doesn't have to be a person. It could be a teacup, you know. It could be a stapler. We could anthropomorphize that light. I mean, Pixar does anthropomorphize, you know, angle poised lights. That's their bloody company identity. and so if the angle poised light is having a problem with authority, Well, you can't project anything onto the anger, poise, light, but the ideas are there as a metaphor, you know, and that's another way in.
That's so powerful. You're absolutely right. It made me, when you were talking there, it made me think of Beauty and the Beast, Disney's Beauty and the Beast, where you've got teacups and teapots and household objects sort of communicating and all that sort of stuff. That's really interesting because you're right. Like, those prejudices do creep in, right or wrong. They're there. We got brought up a certain way, and our conditioning, our programming, whatever you want to call it, is going to take over. You know, that's why they tell people in the military, trust your training, because when emotions are high, trust your training, because you're probably not going to cognitively make any very wise decisions.
Yeah.
But the other part of it as well is, it sounds to me like you're taking an approach of, you know, with children, they don't do what you tell them. They just don't. Matter of fact, you can always guarantee as soon as you tell them to do something, they could do the opposite. So what it sounds like you're doing is you're planting a seed, and it's up to them to nurture it. And if you do it in a certain way, which is what you do and what animation does, it does it in this creative way with music and colors and storytelling. And it's something that you feel inclined to nurture, I think. Whereas if you're just told, right, this is the way to do something, like, I remember the Highway Code when we were kids, and they would tell you about the Highway Code. There was a defiance in me. Like, that doesn't really make any sense. Like, it's like, you will get run over, Johnny. But there was a defiance in me because I was being told what to do, you know? But when you see an animation of a story, you know, of somebody potentially getting knocked over or whatever, it has much more of an impact.
Just to extend this idea out a little bit further, one of the problems with some illnesses, psychological illness, is the stigma that's attached to it. I mean, let's go to addiction. So there's a hell of a stigma attached to alcoholism. So suppose you could, and that stigma isn't value free. That stigma is the result of people saying, I am not going to admit to my problem, and all those layers we were talking about before, because I'm ashamed, I'm guilty, I'm embarrassed, I'm confirming, I'm like my father, I'm, you know, whatever that is. Yeah. Now, using the animation, you can create a metaphor that dignifies that person's position, right? So say, you know, you could animate a Greek myth. You could animate a story that can take that person on a journey. Do you know Joseph Campbell and so Joseph Campbell was a writer. He did a thing called A Hero of a Thousand Faces and a few other things. He was a Jungian, and his best mate was George Lucas. And George Lucas did Star Wars, which is the hero's journey. I mean, it's well documented sort of script narrative. There's seven stages to it, or three, depending on you. Anyway, but that journey that Luke Skywalker went on was leaving home, meeting a counselor, Yoda, and coming back home, returning to kill, wait for it, Darth Vader, the Dark Father, right? So there you've got a hero's journey. Now you've actually said to somebody that you're not some awful alcoholic that is it a disease or is it a choice? And let's not get caught up in reads on that one. Let's just take your journey as not a problem. Yours is a symptom. The alcohol is a symptom, not a problem. What's a symptom of? It's as simple as something that is on your shadow side, which you have to then try to work through in order for you to return home. And by changing that, which is what animation did, by changing that approach to mental health, you're going to have a very different outcome. But animation.
Sure. You've just changed everything for me with Star Wars. I feel like I need to rewatch it. That's amazing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're really absolutely right. Yeah, that's amazing. I'm gonna have to make a note of that.
it's just another route in. Yeah. You know, it's another route in because people are frozen, right? And they're not gonna pick up text. I mean, look at this. This half of that bookcase is about alcoholism. You know, somebody's going to come in day one. I've been sober for 12 hours. Yeah, okay, here, go and read those three books. What? I'm not reading any books. Well, let's discuss God. Let's go on some epistemological quest. No, you just need something right now that I can hold on to to stop me picking up in the next 24 hours.
Yeah, and I can hear as well is that validation of your emotions. You said something earlier that made me think. I was talking to a client the other day, and they telling me they just feel sad. And I said to them, you know, what's making you feel sad? because I never ask why, because why always makes people go internally instead of I want them to look outwards a little bit more.
Brilliant.
And I said, what's making you feel sad? And they told me what was a sad story. And all I did was I wasn't telling them anything. I was just acknowledging, well, that's all very sad. So it sounds like feeling sad's the correct response, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like we feel like that's wrong, that we shouldn't feel sad when sad things happen. But no, we should validate our emotions. This is sad, and it's okay to be sad, but it's that addiction that leans towards the avoidance of being sad. You know, I don't want to feel this way, so I'm going to outsource my emotions to alcohol or drugs or sex or gambling, whatever it is, you know, because I get this feeling that it's not feeling sad. you know?
Yeah, definitely. You're afraid of going into that emotional state, which really, you know, society takes an interesting view of. Mm-hmm. When sitting down and staying with those emotions, and reflecting on them and processing on them, as the Americans would say, you know, is really a worthwhile exercise. Because if you don't do it, then, you know, what's going to happen? You're just going to be prone to feeling those things again. And then if you don't process, you're just going to act it out. It's just going to come out another way. And
compassionately, it makes sense. You don't want to feel these really horrible emotions, so you avoid them. In principle, it makes sense. But, you know, I think where it gets dangerous is when we get into that rumination territory. Yeah. Where it's like, okay, there's validating your emotions. Now you're starting to ruminate. Now you're ruminating. Now we're getting to the point of, you know, like I was speaking to someone a little while ago who had suffered with grief.
Yeah.
I know a client was telling me about somebody that had suffered with grief. She had suffered with grief. And she said to me, I couldn't believe it. I asked this lady when her partner passed, and she said 20 years ago. And I was like, oh wow. And it's, you know, and her partner was a bit more recently than that. And two things happened to her. One, she was like, blimey, I've got another X amount of years of this sort of thing. But then she was just like, why haven't you let go? Why haven't you moved on? You know, what are you holding on to, sort of thing? And I think that's where addiction is born, because there is this familiarity in the comfort of ruminating around things that make us feel sad, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, mm-hmm. It's a shame, and it's a real trap, you know? And that's where I want to sort of come on to sort of your experience with addiction. I mean, would you be kind enough to share that with us?
Sure. Sure. So my father was an alcoholic. In the very broadest sense of the words, you could say he was a functioning alcoholic, because he made money. You know, he did three TV commercials. He did one for Samaritz cigarettes, he did one for Double Diamond beer, and he did one for Ski Yogurt, and they were $3,000 each. And this was back in 1968, where you could buy a house for $12,000, you know. So everyone, just take a moment and just remember those days. Yeah, tissue? Would you like a tissue? No.
You couldn't buy a brochure for that much. it's a bit crazy.
So he managed to, and then, you know, with Empire Strikes Back and Full Metal Jacket, and he's successful. If anybody wants to IMDb him, you can, Bruce Bower. And so the house was, I think there's a Scots expression, fur coat, no knickers, mm-hmm. You know? So we had the house, but we didn't have any money, you know? So my mother went out to work, and we were left at home with a guy who was, he's pretty volatile, right? Let's just leave it there. In my 20s, I was dabbling with alcohol, and in my 20s and 30s, that tolerance level went up, or whatever happened. I was getting more and more involved with alcohol. So to the point where I eventually in my 40s, I was doing, you know, two, three bottles of wine a day, and really, you know, classically, stereotypically, boringly, you know, stereotypically doing what everybody did. You know, I was just drinking heavily the whole time and thinking it was normal, and bringing a constellation of friends around me who were doing the same, and we were having a high old time, and we were doing video and animation. It was a laugh, and it was all going great, until until eventually, you know, the wheels fell off. And through a series of rock bottoms, none of which were terrible, honestly, Johnny. I mean, I didn't flip my car. I didn't, you know, I was a genial drunk. I never hit anyone. I didn't lose my job because, you know, basically I was the boss. Nothing actually terribly happened, and there's a few incidents, but I just thought I cannot continue to live like this. You know, waking up in the morning craving alcohol at 8:30 in the morning. Are you kidding? What? You know, but I couldn't stop. I tried everything. I tried to reduce the quantities. I tried to reduce what I was drinking, when I was drinking it, you know, the weekends on, the weekdays off. And I just couldn't, whatever I tried, I couldn't stop it. So I bounced in and out of AA a few times. Every story they said in there, that's not me. I couldn't identify with that. You know, they flipped their car. I haven't done that, straight down to all bins, you know, and then back in about 3 months later. No, that's not me again. Until eventually I found a little group in Richmond, which they were my tribe. And they just said, look, you know, just come and stay with us if you want and hang out. And those are the people that were and still are, you know, my best buddies. And that was 8 years ago. So, but a day at a time, obviously. And the road to recovery was the sort of the pink cloud to begin with, and everything was going great. And then, as they say, you know, if you want to find out why you drank, just stop drinking. Mm-hmm. And that started all bubble up. And so I started to deal with that. Yeah. And continue to deal with that. But God, you know, it's a hell of a lot better than just running and just thinking, what is that thing that's in the back of my mind? You turn around, face it, and you can right size it and deal with it, and then surround yourself with people. You know, I do believe that the opposite of addiction is connection. Mm. And AA has been terrific for me. I'm God light. So I in terms of God, I see it as an acronym. I know there are Bible thumping AA 12 steppers out there who'd take exception to that. But I mean, I see God as an acronym, you know, like it's a great outdoors, or it's a group of drunks, or it's a general orderly direction. And that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I mean, AA and its connection to religion has often been a barrier, hasn't it, for some people? It can be a barrier because I didn't do 12 steps myself. But, you know, this is the funny thing. Whether you like it or not, you do end up doing the 12 steps, whether you do it knowingly or not, you end up going through the whole process just naturally, because that is the process in a sense. But you hit upon something really interesting there, and that is how you felt about your addiction, because this is what people get all confused about, is they feel they've got challenges around alcohol, or they're not sure about their relationship with alcohol. They just have this feeling that something is wrong, or something isn't right, or something could be better. And they talk to their mates about it, and their mates say, oh no, you're all right. I drink way more than that. I've been to doctors before and spoken to them, and they're like, oh, well, I drink more than that, you'll be all right. But what they're not acknowledging is my issue with it. And that's what I loved about what you just said. Then you're like, it's me. I've got a problem with this. I don't want to be this person. This is not who I am or who I want to be. Yeah. And what I want to take from that is that's enough. Yeah. That is enough of a reason to go sober.
Yeah.
You don't need anyone else's validation. You don't need someone to tell you, yeah, you've got a problem, you should do this, or tell you they're proud of you or not proud of you. It's about you and your relationship with addiction. And I really respect you sort of saying that.
Oh, thanks. I think it's right. There's no point doing a straw poll or some market research about, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Do you think I'm an alcoholic? Because what are you going to get? You know, just, you know, I mean, by any metric, I was an alcoholic and was for some time. You know, I could tick off all of the little questionnaires that you see from time to time. You know, do you do this? Do you do this? Do you not do this? When do you do this? And it's like, yep, every single one, you know. And I could still come up with, nah, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, crack open the Pinot Grigio or whatever, and, you know, or lager or whatever, and do it. But But you, I, it's, eventually, look, I mean, I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know, and I tried to outrun it. I tried to outthink it, but I couldn't. I couldn't. It just got me. But the tail started wagging the dog and I couldn't stop. So the only thing I could do was just on a day-to-day basis, just wake up and if you know, those old scripts are there, of course, they're really hardwired in, but there's now I live my life another way. And it's, you know, God, it's a hell of a lot better for it. Jesus.
Yeah. And I can hear all that sort of like, it's other people's sort of value systems that apply all that judgment and labeling of you're an alcoholic or you're a problematic drinker or you're a gray area drinker. And to some extent, that's helpful. But to others, it's kind of just, you're just delaying the inevitable. It's almost like, does it really matter? Does it actually matter what you are? You're not happy with this setup that you've got going on right now. And that's what's important. And it's like people say to me, oh, how do you know that you need to change your relationship with alcohol? Well, the fact that you're asking the question is probably a good sign.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't, you know, so therefore, if you're saying to me, how do you know? I'd say you probably know, you know.
Well, just give it a break for a month. You know, the pubs will still be open when you decide to go back on it.
Yeah.
Almost certainly the pubs will still be there or they'll still be selling Jack Daniels, you know, in the local corner store. You know, just give it a try and see how you get on.
Yeah.
Because for me personally, it was a revolution in my life. It was an inflection point that once I got a couple of weeks under my belt, I just never looked back. And I really, I'm so pleased being sober and closing that chapter and putting it behind me. But one of the things that had come out of it is, you know, what is that in The Wire? What was that line that, he said, you know, it's all in the game, isn't it? So now I'm on the other side of the game, you know, now I'm dealing with alcohol, but on the other side of the game. And my way of sort of doing service is just talking about my experiences and just saying, well, you know, God, if it chimes with you, then great. You know, if there's something I've said that rings a bell and makes you think in a different way about things, and just give it a go. You know, it's not, you're saving yourself some money. You're saving it. You're going to probably be thinner for it. You're probably, you know, going to, there's all sorts of pluses apart from the fact that you're just going to give it a go.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what? I mean, one of my favorite things is this idea of the straight and narrow. When you know, people say when you go on the wagon, you're on the straight and narrow. Nah, when you're sober, you've got options. It's when you're the alcoholic that you're on the straight and narrow, because you know where you're going to be. You know when you're going to go to the offie. You know how you're going to feel. And so does everyone around you, right? that's not freedom. That's just some sort of hyper-controlled way of living that there's no, then the only way to break that is to go sober. Because when you got sober, you got options, you got different ways you can think about things, different places you can go, you do, be, feel, you know, you got options.
And no one says it's easy. And I love what you said there about if you want to know why you drink, stop drinking, because that was said to me, and that was that was a turning point to me. My mentor Malachi Dunn, he said that to me. He said a lot of things to me, like them sort of little sayings like that, and it's true. It's so true, because to me, there's two initial steps. There's obviously the abstinence of alcohol, but then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I can't outsource my emotions. What is this feeling I'm having? I just wanted to, you know, my dog never got walked so much. And the first 2 weeks when I wasn't drinking, because I was just like, I don't know what to do with this feeling I have. And that's when I realized that I don't have cravings. This inanimate object, this bottle of liquid doesn't have control over me. I offer it control. It's like, what am I doing here? What's actually happening? Oh, I'm experiencing emotions. And it's not a craving. It's a reaction. Drinking is a reaction. It's not a craving, because this bottle does not have that control. It cannot. It's a bottle of liquid. Why does this bottle of liquid have so much control over me more than a 7-Up or you know whatever? And obviously, I know it's more complex than that. But I it's interesting that, because I'd never heard anyone else say that, and now you said that, that's interesting. But I also wanted to get your perspective on I think sometimes when it comes to addiction, and I'm talking about addiction as whatever it is, you know, people get very focused on the thing that they're addicted to.
Yeah.
So if someone's addicted to food, they think, oh, okay, I'm overweight, potentially I'm going to go to a slimming club, and the slimming club encourages them to focus solely on food. Mm-hmm. Here we go, focus on food. But that doesn't really solve the problem, because it's not necessarily the food. It's the addiction. That's just the weapon that addiction uses in order to get you addicted. And for us, it was alcohol. For some people, it's drugs. I always think it's a shame that you have Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeating Anonymous. Should it just been called Addictions Anonymous? Because it's the same principles, isn't it? I wonder what your thoughts are on addiction as a whole, against the idea that, oh, you're addicted to alcohol, you need to focus on that. You're addicted to food, sex, whatever it is, porn. And then you focus on those things instead of the actual addiction.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we talk about sugar donuts, imagine if you never had a sugar donut, and then you go and somebody gives you a sugar donut, and you taste that sugar donut, and mind blowing, right? This is an amazing texture. The icing sugar's there. The crunchiness of it, or the texture of the dough, that's just fantastic. And then you go away having finished the donut, and you think, I'd really fancy another one of those donuts. And that's the arousal curve starts then. Mm. It's the anticipation of the donut. And neurochemically, this is where there's some really interesting research. Neurochemically, what happens is just thinking about it starts the band playing, right? Mm. So the dopamine's going in there, the endorphins are going in there, and you're starting to think about it. Okay, now you're thinking about the donut. Now you want to go and get the donut. Okay, because you're anticipating what's going to happen. You haven't had the donut yet. It's an inert bloody object, like your bottle of liquor, you know, like your liquid. It's a donut, for Christ's sake. You're putting all of that stuff onto the donut, but you're still going to go for it. And then you have the donut. And guess what? It may be great. It may not. The chances are it's not going to be as good as you thought it was going to be. It's the anticipation of it. And that's why, in terms of addiction, that the iterative good feeling. It's not a consistent every single time. It's that sometimes it's good, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not great, but you're constantly drawn back to it. And that's why, you know, gambling, for example, one-armed bandits or even, you know, Instagram for that matter, you know, you go back to it and you want that hit. Sometimes it's the wanting of the hit and then the hit. So if you look at addiction, I mean, if you go back, regardless of the substance, whether it's roulette or Jack Daniels or donuts, it's the anticipation of it starts the thing going, and then there's a consummation of it, you know, that's how I think of it. That's where I'm at today on it, thinking about it anyway. And neurochemically, it seems to be, if you put somebody in an MRI scanner and you flash up Jack Daniels on the inside of their goggles, boom, there's the light, you know?
Interesting.
And the thing is, Johnny, that because we have blind sight, so the eyes work at 30 megahertz a second or whatever it is, but we have blind sight. So we see things before we actually see it. So that light will flash up before you're consciously aware of it. You know, your ability, that's why, you know, I think it's so important to stay in dry places or to watch, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, because then your guard's down and that anticipatory response can happen and you're not cognitively aware of it, but you're still thinking, oh, hang on, something's not quite right. Oh, hang on, I get it now. It's this. Sorry, I was rambling a bit there.
No. Some of my hardest days were literally solved by me going to bed.
Yeah.
At like 7:30, 8 o'clock, because I was struggling. I was struggling, and it was just that I was tired. And you're so right. And I don't think people speak about this enough. Those basic needs. It's like the person that holds in a wee. Like, I have a client and they're sat like this, and I'm like, do you need to go for a wee? And it's like, yeah, do you mind? I'm like, why didn't you just go? They're like, oh, you know, I didn't want to. And I think to myself, right, okay, that's a fundamental need that you have. If you're neglecting the need to go for a wee, what else are you neglecting on a bigger scale than that? You know, because it gets really interesting at that point for me. So for me, it's like, if you need to go to the toilet, if you're hungry, if you're tired, if, you know, you've had a collection of stressy things happen in your day, and that could just be, you know, you hit every red light on the school run. Could be anything. Yeah. It doesn't have to be anything horrendous. Like, that's enough, really, I think.
Yeah.
It's enough to cause someone to drink. And it's like, the guy that I worked with, he said to me that it most likely won't be the bad things that catch you out. It will be the good things when it comes to alcohol. It'll be the person that turns up who's just passed the driving test and they turn up with a bottle of champagne and they'll catch you out. That's where you'll have that real feeling of, oh, maybe I could just have one. Because there's almost a bit of prep when something bad happens. It's sort of you know you can't turn to this because it's a bad time. But it doesn't seem so bad. Look, it's a happy occasion. I can have a glass of wine or I can have a glass of champagne. What then, though?
Yeah.
Because that's when you've just woken up the addiction monster and he says, oh, I thought we weren't friends anymore. But it seems like...
Oh, yeah.
It seems like we're back in the game again. Let's go.
Yeah. You're anthropomorphizing the booze, right?
Yeah.
You're almost anthropomorphizing your own mind there. It's great. There's a song by Johnny Cash called The Beast in Me. I don't know if you ever heard it.
No, I do like Johnny Cash, though.
Yeah, but he did it. It's called The Beast in Me. I think it was written by a son-in-law. And one of the lines is, sometimes it tries to fool me that it's just a teddy bear and even tries to fool me that it isn't even there. And that is when I must be aware of the beast in me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's giving me goosebumps. that's mega. That's a really good little bit of a line that.
Go on.
Just on the last question, really, like, just as we close down, I've really enjoyed this conversation. We've gone all over the place with it. And I love those type of conversations. But is there anything that you'd like to pass on to the people listening that you feel could help them with their self-development?
I get asked this. I just the basics, mind, body, spirit. So body is, you know, sleep hygiene. You sort of talked about there, hydration, exercise, diet, just somehow, you know, get an equilibrium with that. And then in terms of mind, you've got the psychology of what you're doing. So, you know, if you can meditate, think about your thinkings, try and gain some perspective, put aside some time to really think about how you're working cognitively, and read. And then spirit is I think everybody, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think everybody has a relationship to something larger than themselves, whether that's the great outdoors or someone said to me the other day that they were trying to explain God, and they said that, you know, you can pick up a book and you can read it. Now you don't understand, you have an insight into the mind of the author through reading the book. So maybe you have an insight into something bigger by living. Tony Bennett, when Amy Winehouse died, Tony Bennett said, life teaches you how to live as long as you live long enough to learn.
Wow. Right? Wow. Whoa.
Good one.
That is a good one.
So, you know, as we go through life, you know, clearly, you know, you're very, very self-aware and you're, you know, you learn, you pick up these things as you go on, and then you can design your life and you can see where, but it's everybody's personal journey. It's everybody's personal process. And I think we're too caught up on people dealing with, you know, with rote, with authority, with tradition, or by put down by society, or by parents. You know, I mean, you know, the top 10 wishes of the dying. There's a book called The Top 10 Wishes of the Dying. It was just written by a palliative nurse. And number one or number two up there was, I wish I'd lived my own life. I wish I'd lived my own life. And, yeah, ouch.
Yeah, blimey. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I get that feeling. I would never have classified myself as a spiritual person until I went sober. And then spirituality just kept popping up everywhere for me. And where I found it the most, the place that gives me a feeling that I don't get anywhere else, that's, that I don't know how to articulate, is any form of mountains.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, whenever I go to Snowdon or Scotland or anywhere like that, just you hear kids especially say, awesome, awesome. And it's like when you really think about it, like you're in awe of something. It literally makes me speechless when I see mountains. Yeah. I can't believe what I'm seeing. It creates a feeling in me that I can't get anywhere else, not even from alcohol. You know, so yeah. I know that if I'm struggling a little bit, it's time to plan a mountain trip, you know, and do some mountain stuff.
Well, isn't that something? So you see, you have a sense of the miraculous in your everyday life.
Mm.
And you can connect with that.
Yeah.
And I think that is fundamental to it, because I mean, is it fair to say, Johnny, I mean, phrase it as a question, that the more people get involved with addiction, the less open to there being something outside of their particular relationship to something. It becomes very, very confined, claustrophobic. Yeah. They can't see beyond that dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go on. With you in the mountains, it's...
Yeah, but I mean, it's like people describe alcohol as like the devil's juice and stuff. And it's like, you can see why, because it does. It stops you from, like, I didn't care. I went on mountaineering trips before. And in Scotland, I went because it ended with a pub that was filled with whiskey. So I literally endured 5 Monroe Mountains just to drink whiskey at the end. And I look back now and I don't remember doing it. And it's like, that's ridiculous. You know, that's ridiculous. Like, I'm going to stop short of being unkind to myself. But now I'm doing the mountains, you know, and there's so many metaphors, you know, with the mountains, climbing up the mountains, doing hard things, enjoying the journey, getting to the top, summiting, all them different things. And I just love it. I love it. I remember I got to take my wife and kids to Snowdon a few years ago. And I always like to lead on the mountain. I like to have the map and the compass and all that. But I lead from behind because I like to see everybody. So I was just watching my family just experiencing the mountains in different ways and going through these different experiences. 1 minute, someone's really struggling and it's really hard, like steep climb. Next minute, they're in awe of a lake or some snow. Next minute, they're laughing at a sheep going for a poo or something, you know, and it's just all these little life happening moments, you know, that you didn't expect. And when you see it, you're just like, this is amazing. And you just really, you learn this real appreciation, I think it's the word.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I think you're very lucky to have that. That's a wonderful thing to have, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't do it enough. I'm realizing that in this moment, I don't do it enough. Definitely. But another thing that you said was great was like almost like that you're gesturing towards the idea of making an appointment with yourself.
Mm.
You know, our diaries are full all the time of all these people we've got to see, whether it's virtually or in person. But when do we actually make an appointment with ourselves? And, you know, you alluded to potentially meditation or just some reflective thinking. But the whole idea is just spending a moment to check in with yourself and just ask yourself, how you doing? You know?
Yeah.
You're right.
And to sit down with a pencil and a piece of paper and just, you know, just draw out some of the ways that you're thinking about things to try and, you know, use another part of your brain to examine maybe there's other ways of looking at things. Mm. What are the alternatives? And they come up. They do come up. Yes, a sense of the miraculous in everyday life. That's what to get to, because Jesus. There's, you know, as Einstein said, you know, you either treat life as if it's just not a miracle, or you treat it like every second's a miracle. There's enough going on just inside our bodies right now that we have no control of whatsoever. And you know, the fact that, you know, I don't even know if I am a body or if I have a body, you know, let's get into the linguistics around it, you know, and we're sitting on this blue marble in the middle of the arse end of some galaxy that, you know, is, you look at the James Webb stuff that's coming through at the moment. I mean, it's just mind blowing. And to live at this time, there's enough miracles out there to sit there and go, Jesus, what, you know, just stunning. Yeah. And we've only got 10 minutes left to live, haven't we? So, you know, well, let's just appreciate it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you're right. Like, when you speak to people at the back end of their life, the advice they give you is not have a six pack. Yeah. It's often like spend more time with this person, or make sure you do this, or never leave the house without giving your partner, embracing your partner in some way, whatever. But it's often the things that we think we've got always got time for, but we don't realize that, you know. It's
this is one of the things that I see with our employees. I mean, I think the average age in the company is something like 25 or something, and I see them all the time WhatsApping, you know, texting, DMing one another. And what they're not doing is picking up the phone and having a conversation. You know, have a conversation. We're living in this sort of hyper-connected, hyper-personalized. This is what our clients say. Give me another video over the spiral that does hyper-personalized connectivity. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, fine. But you know, pick up the goddamn telephone and call someone. How are you feeling today? Just checking in, you know, and have that conversation. And see what comes up, because honestly, we're becoming so, the irony of it is we have, you know, 10,000 friends on Instagram, and no one, you know, to really talk to and say, actually, you know what, I'm feeling pretty down today. This happened. Has it ever happened to you?
It's the illusion of that we've never been so connected, but we're actually very disconnected because we're not actually, we're talking surface level stuff, you know, commenting on somebody's post, or, you know, oh, what a lovely picture. And, you know, it can go deep, really, couldn't it? It really could.
Yeah.
But we must bring it to the end. I've really loved this conversation. Thank you so much.
John, me too.
Just one last thing. What's next for you, and where can people find you? Social media, anything you want to bring their attention to before we wrap up?
Well, obviously the website is shootyou.com, which is where a lot of our best work is from a professional point of view. From a personal point of view, I'm dialing up what I'm doing with the animations and mental health. So my IG account is at Quint Boa. So have a look there, and please have a look at any of the animations and give me some feedback so I can make them better. What I want to do is do more of these animations, get them out there in schools, get them out there in within the NHS, get them in with employers, and to really raise the level. I've got a book out. This is not a book promotion. This is £6 on Amazon. And you know, obviously I'm not making any money off the back of it, but it's an interesting idea, which is basically, it's that the power of animation is the application to mental health and well-being, which goes more into depth about, you know, what we've been talking about in this podcast.
Yeah.
And I really think that animation has got a place in education, in NHS, in with employers, employer relations, all of it. And that's really what I want to push, Johnny. Honestly, that's all I want to do from here on in. Because I love it. Love animation, love psychology, love philosophy. And I even love talking to you on these wonderful subjects.
Oh, so did I. I've definitely got my, I have this theory around philosophical loneliness. Is when you can be in a room full of people and still feel lonely because they want to talk about Love Island and you want to talk about ideas. Now, there's nothing wrong with Love Island. It's just not my bag. But I've definitely got my philosophical loneliness fixed today, for sure. You know, so thank you very much for that.
And it's been great, Johnny.
It would be terrible of me not to mention I can see Sober Dave's book in the background. So he'll like that.
Yeah, he will. There he is. Sober Dave,
I love it. Yeah. Right, listen, Quint, thank you so much. I really valued this, and I look forward to the idea of doing it again someday.
Yeah, brilliant. Yes, thanks ever so much, John. It's been great talking to you. Thanks.
So that's all from me for this episode. Thanks again to my podcast producer, Charlie, from Chatter Podcast, and I'll catch you next time for another episode of the Self-Development Podcast.